From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When you're talking to seismologists, the question that inevitably comes up is, when are we going to be able to forecast an earthquake? And the answer is complicated. But for now, scientists can't really offer much of a prediction. They can get you in the ballpark, like, say, within 30 years. But as the seismologist Mary Lou Zoback explained, earthquakes are the result of a dynamic, chaotic, natural process. Or as the historian Will Durant put it, civilization exists by geological consent, subject to change without notice. Still, we are learning more and more about earthquakes, and today in the program we're going to talk about it. What we know and don't know, what it will mean when a big one strikes, and whether we'll be ready for it. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you live in a place that is known for seismic activity, like here along the Wasatch Front in Utah, you think about earthquakes from time to time. And the refrain you hear again and again is, not if, but when. And what would that mean, a significant quake, when it does come? A 2009 study based on a computer simulation found that of the 2 million people who live along the Wasatch Front, we're talking Salt Lake County, Davis, Weber, Tooele, Summit, Box Elder, and the others. Of the 2 million people, a magnitude 7.0 quake would kill up to 2,900 people, depending on the time of day. It would mean up to 11,000 people hospitalized, some 97,000 people homeless, at least temporarily. And you find the same kind of figures in communities around the country, around the world. So today in the program, we decided to talk about earthquakes, about what scientists are learning about earthquakes, what a big one could mean for the Wasatch Front and other places, and whether we're really ready when it comes. Joining us today in the program is Mary Lou Zoback, a geophysicist and vice president of earthquake risk applications for Risk Management Solutions. It's a catastrophe risk consulting firm. She also served as chief scientist for the USGS Earthquake Hazards Team. Joining us from the campus of Stanford University in California. And Mary Lou Zoback, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Keith Koper is joining us also here in the studio, director of seismograph stations and an associate professor of geophysics at the University of Utah. Here in the studio again, Keith Koper, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
And Bob Carey is with us, operations chief and earthquake program manager for the Utah Division of Homeland Security. And Mr. Carey, welcome to you. Thanks for being
with us. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I wanted to start, Mary Lou Zoback, I wanted to start with you on this subject. And I guess it, in some ways, maybe it seems beside the point, but I am interested in what it is that drew you to the subject of earthquakes in the first place.
That's actually a good question, since I grew up in Florida, one of the few states that rarely has earthquakes.
Wow.
But when I was going to college, plate tectonics had really just burst out on the scene. And probably the most fundamental information on plate tectonics comes from earthquakes. And that really drew me into how the plates were moving and why they were moving.
So what about it, though? I mean, what did you, were you, was it, what about it, I guess? What in particular? Just the science of it? That was an emerging science then?
It was an emerging science, but also I've always been interested in the landscape around me. Hmm. And it's so bad that when I go see movies and they say they're in a certain state or a certain region, I can tell whether or not they were actually filmed there. I was interested in what causes the landscape that we see. Why are mountains there? Why are valleys here? That sort of thing. And for the most part, earthquakes are the reason.
How much of our images of earthquakes are influenced by disaster films, you know, by popular culture? I mean, because I'm interested in fact, I want to get all of your perspective on just how you think sort of mainstream people actually think about earthquakes, if they think about them at all, and what they seem to know or not know about them.
It's an interesting dichotomy, I think. We're fascinated by disaster, any kind of disaster, and certainly the news media plays into that fascination by focusing on, I remember after the 1989 earthquake in the Bay Area, when I came home and one little glass vase had fallen over, but all my friends from Europe were calling to say, are you all right? Can you still go in your home? because all their image was the Bay Bridge collapsing and the fires in the Marina District. And I had to explain that's very localized. But I think the interesting dichotomy and the sort of the flip side of this is that, you know, we're fascinated by the damage and the destruction, but we're also completely living in denial that it could ever happen to us. That's true in California, and I wager to bet it's true in Utah.
Bob Carey, you just mouthed to me, said, not me. I'm not in denial. But I wonder if the people that you're supposed to be dealing with are, what are you finding? Are Utahns in denial? You may not be, but I wonder, most of us, are we?
Well, we've been doing the awareness part for a long time, and I think there's a level, people understand having 72-hour kits, and they understand there's reasons why that is. I don't know if they know the extent of what the problem could look like, and that's where having this HAZES run that we've used to develop earthquake scenarios with is really helping now convey the quantitative side of the earthquakes for these people.
Because it makes a difference to hear, not just a lot of people are going to get hurt, but there could be up to 2,900 people who would die.
Yeah, that brings a stark face to it. Yeah. And then in the, you know, in the recent events, the earthquakes in China, which have some relationship to us in building types, I think New Zealand in particular is a definite face of what could happen here in the Salt Lake Valley in particular on this particular segment of the fault.
Mm. Keith Cooper, what about you? We're thinking about what do you hear? How do you think people are thinking or not about earthquakes?
Well, I think one of the problems in our area here in Salt Lake is that the recurrence interval of earthquakes is relatively long. So we might have a large earthquake every 300 years, 400 years, 500 years, something like that. Whereas along a plate boundary, so in California or Alaska, you know, it's more in the consciousness of the people that you do have these big earthquakes. But here, you know, once a generation, we don't have a big earthquake. And so it's something that we're always trying to educate people and make people aware that, as you said earlier, there's definitely going to be another big earthquake sometime in the future. It's going to happen. It's just that we don't know precisely when. So the best thing to do is be prepared.
Mary Lou Zoback, let me ask you, is the Earth, you know, China, of course, Chile, there was Haiti, there was New Zealand. Is that significant? The sense is the Earth particularly busy right now? Or, I mean, earthquakes are happening all the time. So are we just sort of, are these just happen to be bigger ones? Are there more events now than have been? I mean, put that in context for us.
Sure. And it's an interesting question and one that comes up often. Actually, if we look at 2010, which, you know, there was the Haiti earthquake, there's Chile earthquake, it's very much on our minds. But if we look at the globally at the number of earthquakes that occurred in the different magnitude ranges, it's really no different than any other year. And we have very long-term statistics now, 30, 40 years, and on average, we don't see an increase in the level of activity. But what we are seeing, and we're going to continue to see, is that there are going to be more and more destructive earthquakes, and largely because more and more people are moving into harm's way, particularly in the developing world. A lot of these cities are in seismically prone regions, and people are living in basins which tend to amplify the shaking. And there's a lot of really poor people living in substandard construction, homes they've built themselves, that are going to kill them.
Let me ask you, I want to get a sense of earthquakes themselves, like it's the physics of them or the nature of them. Let me ask you this way, Mary Lou Zoback, you first. Do all earthquakes feel the same?
No, not at all. And several factors affect how an earthquake feels, how an individual perceives an earthquake. First, of course, it depends on the size and the distance you are away from the earthquake. Basically, all earthquakes are seismic energy being released in a really rapid short time frame. This energy had accumulated over tens, hundreds, sometimes thousands of years. You can think of it as sort of stretching an elastic sheet or a rubber band. At some point, it's going to break. And when it breaks, in the case of a rubber band, you hear a noise. That's equivalent to the seismic energy. So all earthquakes have an initial P wave that travels fastest. That's when we're first aware. And that usually comes in as a sharp jolt. Mm. But the real damage is caused by later waves coming in, beginning with what we call the shear wave or the S wave. And these waves create a lot of shaking in the ground, and sometimes if they get trapped in near surface layers can go on for a long time. So a really large earthquake like the Sumatran or the Chilean earthquake, they actually cause the entire earth to ring, and that can go on for days. Wow. So, but what you normally will feel if there's a moderate earthquake nearby is the initial sensation will be something like a sharp jolt. You might think a truck hit your building, something like that. But then if you wait a few seconds, and the time between the P and S wave is just like thunder and lightning, it can tell you the distance to an earthquake. Soon you'll start feeling this stronger shaking, and lines might start rattling, or depending on how strong, things might start toppling over, bookcases and such.
Yeah. Keith Koper, let me ask you, and Bob, you too, on this question. Okay, so let me, I'm going to put myself in the downtown Salt Lake City. And a magnitude 7 earthquake, a large earthquake, hits the Wasatch Fault somewhere. What's going to happen? First of all, what am I going to feel, and your sense of what's going to happen?
Well, the shaking is going to be severe from a magnitude 7, you know, especially if it's along the Salt Lake City segment of the Wasatch.
We're talking back and forth?
Yeah, the shaking will last for, you know, potentially tens of seconds.
Right.
The very strong shaking. Buildings are going to collapse. You know, not all buildings are built up to code.
Yeah.
You know, some of the older buildings are unreinforced masonry, for instance. Those will fail. You'll have liquefaction of the ground. So the ground with a strong shaking will actually lose its strength, okay, and that can cause things to essentially weaken and sink into the ground. You can have landslides that can also cause damage, you know, here, you know, right in the foothills, essentially, and so you could have a landslide hazard. It would be pretty scary and pretty severe to have a 7 sort of right here in the city.
Yeah. Bob, what do you think?
Well, when you look at the growth of Salt Lake City and Salt Lake County, and this is where the center of the earthquake is going to happen, I think you'll see a definite pattern of damage that comes from that. Keith alluded to a building type that an organization that we participate in, the Utah Seismic Safety Commission, has been chasing to make awareness of its dangers. These buildings were built, for argument's sake, prior to 1975. So anything that we look at in Utah that's a brick, a masonry building, whether it's brick or block, we consider it unreinforced. They don't perform very well. The attachments of the roof and the floor and the walls together is loose at best. So we equate it to like a house of cards. So when you start looking at areas around the valley, you go from old to new. So we'll see more damage in Salt Lake City proper.
The older part.
The older parts of the other communities, Murray, Sandy, you're going to see similar things like that. But then as you go south and southwest, you're moving into newer construction.
Sure.
And so you would expect to have less damage coming up. That's to buildings. But you still, you know, then there's the infrastructure. There's the roads. There's the water system. Wastewater systems, those are all going to take a pretty decent hit, regardless of being adjacent to the fault, which will offset. There'll be an expression of it. One of the few places along the entire stretch of the fault steps out into a valley is right here in Salt Lake.
Yeah.
So beginning at around 4800 south, the fault actually runs just east of Highland Drive. So now you've got a fault rupturing in the city, not on the mountain edge where it has limited effect there. So we know all these things are going to happen. And in our office, that's where we sit down and try to plot a strategy on how to come back after the fact and deal with this disaster from the government side.
Mary Lou Zoback, you spent some time in Salt Lake City. What's your sense of what could happen in an earthquake like that here? It could be incredibly violent, I guess.
Incredibly violent, and I think Keith and Bob have done a really good job of describing all the potential hazards. Salt Lake City, Salt Lake Valley sort of has them all. They're really strong possibility of liquefaction. as Keith was mentioning, this shaking of soft, sandy, water-saturated soil, which certainly describes a large part of that valley, it essentially turns the ground to something similar to quicksand. And you can imagine airport runways just sort of getting stretched out and breaking up into pieces. And I will say, we just have had engineers come back from Christchurch, New Zealand, and from our company, and we're very interested in the damage because the second more recent earthquake is only a magnitude 6.3. We would normally never expect this level of damage. And I was just looking at their reports this morning. An awful lot of the damage in Christchurch is due to liquefaction. The bigger earthquake last September didn't cause much liquefaction because it was much further from the city center. But this newer earthquake, only a 6.3, was very close to the city, and most of the damage was related to liquefaction. Mm. So I think that's a very real hazard. And certainly, as Bob explained, the older homes and the unreinforced masonry, I believe there's estimates of something like 75,000 unreinforced masonry buildings in Salt Lake Valley. Is that correct, Bob?
Yeah, it's pretty close to what we've been looking at this. When we put hazards together, we pulled the Salt Lake County assessor's data in. And between that and an earlier study, we've come up with it's probably around 65,000 just in Salt Lake County. When you start to look at the four big counties along the front, now our number runs up to 150,000. And then if you look at it as a statewide problem, we have about 180,000 URMs. To put that in perspective, California as a state has roughly only about 25,000 now.
Wow.
And that's because the state actually, most municipalities required building owners to either retrofit the building, the unreinforced masonry buildings, or abandon them. So you are not allowed to use an unreinforced masonry building in California.
You know, it's so interesting. I wonder if the Christchurch itself is a pretty good model for Salt Lake City in some ways. It's a city of about 100 somewhat years old, lots of brick buildings in the older part as well. There might be some lessons there, I suppose, for Salt Lake City.
Yeah, the tectonics are a little bit different in New Zealand as opposed to here in Utah. It's more of a lateral motion of the tectonic plates, and it is actually a plate boundary, whereas we're here in Utah, we're in the middle of a plate.
Right.
But there are some lessons to learn, and I think one of the big ones is something that's already been alluded to, and that is that even if the earthquake is relatively small, a 6.3, there can still be enormous damage. So we have sort of these catastrophic estimates. You know, if there's a magnitude 7, we could have thousands of people injured and so forth. But we can really have significant damage and significant injuries and so forth, even if it is just a magnitude 6, if it's close enough sort of to the urban core.
Well, and to follow up on that a little bit, when we had the Wells earthquake in 2008, we actually modeled that here in Salt Lake County. And we put the epicenter out in Taylorsville, giving it the distance from the epicenter to downtown Salt Lake. Well, we generated about a $3 billion event in building damage from a 6 happening here in the valley, which is really, it was interesting to see the numbers come out on that, because we would have not have expected it to be quite that bad, but it was.
Mm. One other factor I would like to add, a special situation for Salt Lake Valley and the various valleys, the populated valleys along the Wasatch Front. And that is actually something we saw in the Chichi earthquake in Taiwan about 10 years ago. And that's when you have a dipping fault and it ruptures. Earthquakes begin at depth, typically like 10 miles, between 8 and 10 miles depth, and they rupture towards the surface. As they do that, they focus seismic energy upwards. And a lot of that seismic energy in Salt Lake and other basins will get trapped within the basin because of the walls of the basin. Kind of think about it like water in a bathtub if you start sloshing it around. And the waves actually get amplified. Now, we've done some modeling in California for similar size earthquakes. And what we see, the seismic energy getting trapped, what it produces, you can see in animations, the ground surface can move back and forth about 2 feet at a rate of about 2 feet per second, and that can go on for tens of seconds. So you can imagine roads getting ripped apart, all sorts of things. It's going to make life very disrupted.
That's Mary Lou Zoback, Vice President of Risk Application for RMS in Newark, California. Keith Koper with us, Director of the University of Utah Seismograph Stations, and Bob Carey joining us as well here in the studio, Earthquake Program Manager for Utah's Division of Homeland Security. We're going to take a brief break, back in a moment. This is an encore presentation of Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio.
Tomorrow morning at 10:15, the state is sponsoring the largest earthquake drill in Utah history. The Great Shakeout gives Utahns the opportunity to review earthquake safety strategies and plan their own evacuation routes. To join the thousands already signed up for the drill and to learn more, visit us at KUER.org/Radio West.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about earthquakes, talking about the science of earthquakes, what we're learning about them, what one would mean for the Wasatch Front and other places, and whether we'll be ready, how you get ready for such a thing. Mary Lou Zoback is with us, Vice President of Risk Applications for RMS in Newark, California, geophysicist as well. Keith Koper joining us, Director of the Seismograph Stations at the University of Utah, and Bob Carey is with us, Earthquake Program Manager for the Utah Division of Homeland Security. Let's go to the phones. Anna is joining us in Salt Lake City. Anna, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I'm from Christchurch, New Zealand, and we were actually in just outside Christchurch for the 7.1 and managed to be back in Salt Lake by the time the 6.3 came around. Mm-hmm. And I've been reading a lot about the Christchurch earthquake, and one really interesting article was from a guy from the USAR, so Search and Rescue Team from the United States. And in his 25 years of doing earthquake rescue, he talks about the triangle of life, and he says that in the event of an earthquake, the thing to do is not stand under door jams or get under a desk, but to lie beside that desk in fetal position or lie beside a bed in fetal position or a sofa. And where people most often get found alive in buildings is in that triangle of life, where things fall down, but they fall against that immovable object.
Mm. Well, Bob Carey, what do you think?
Well, we've been dealing with this discussion on the triangle of life.
Yeah.
And here in the United States, we don't necessarily believe in it for other reasons. And actually, it comes out of the research that we've done with hazards. When you look at the hazards run, you'll see in the economic side of losses, there's a category for non-structural. Non-structural is all those systems within a building that has nothing to do with the structure. Those tend to get overlooked in construction, so they're not necessarily seismically resistant. And so what we find is that most injuries that we see from earthquakes are not coming from structural collapse or failure. It's coming from non-structural elements from within the building. And so duck and cover does have its place because most buildings don't collapse. And so, yeah, maybe on the few buildings that do, that those procedures may have worked better. Quite frankly, if you had enough time to go out of an unreinforced masonry building, that would be useful. But the threshold of going out the door is where most people get killed from falling objects. So we don't recommend what the caller has indicated. We recommend still ducking and covering. Now, is it 100%? It's not. But it's by far the best way to keep yourself from being hurt, because the triangle of life has you sitting out in the open. So, yeah, it'll protect you maybe from the collapse of the building, but all this non-structural stuff, you're going to be injured from that falling on you during the ground shaking.
Mm. Doug, go ahead.
Yeah, if I might add, this is an urban legend that has received widespread publicity. I would refer the caller and all the listeners to the American Red Cross's webpage. And just when you get on the webpage, search for Triangle Life, and you'll see they strongly disagree with Doug Kopp's recommendations. he has much higher opinion of his qualifications than every emergency responder I've ever met, and many of whom have seen him hanging around the scenes. In the United States, the best advice is duck cover and hold on. As Bob pointed out, things are going to be falling all around you. And even running outdoors, which some people think is a good idea. We had an earthquake on the Central California coast near San Simeon about 7 or 8 years ago. And only two people were killed. Two women that were in a shop and ran outside of the shop, and the facade fell down on them. The shopkeeper inside the shop ducked and covered. She was fine. But the two women that ran outside were killed by bricks falling on them.
Anna, glad you called. Let's go back to the phones. Don is with us in Salt Lake. Don, welcome.
Thanks. I had a couple of questions. I guess it's only one question. I wonder why county governments allow people to build homes in earthquake zones. I mean, if I look at the benches, I think the benches are really just ancient sand dunes that have been uprighted, and there's all kinds of houses up there. Also, if I'm going down 13th East and I look to the west, you can see that the elevation changes by at least 100 feet. So I'm just wondering, why is it that counties who already have a lot of the seismic information continue to allow developers to develop and build houses in those locations? Mm. And I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Bob Carey, let me start with you. It's a great question. It's not like we just learned that, hey, there's a fault here.
Yeah, I think what you're seeing is that we really didn't have a firm handle on exactly all the science. And so back in the 80s, the USGS came in and there was a more formal study was being done then. But by then, you know, most of the northern end of the valley's been populated by that time. It's not been lost. Salt Lake County does have a natural hazards code now. And when you go to build in and around certain elements, whether it's liquefaction, whether it's a fault trace, there are certain requirements that have to be followed. Now, Keith and I are probably going to agree on the fact that a 50-foot offset on the fault's probably not enough, but it's a compromise. You have a very strong development in the front, and so it's better than straddling the fault. I mean, short of that, you know, because there's a deformation zone that forms out in front and sometimes behind the fault, and that can vary. It's never our problem is things are not always black and white. In some places, you'll see minimal movement adjacent to the fault. In other areas, it can extend several hundred feet out in front. We had a gentleman the other day at a conference that I was at from Napa, and he was describing damage in his community. And it was really interesting that in one area, all the homes were green because that's how they were inspected, except for one at the very end of the cul-de-sac. And that one was red. And white, I mean, it stuck out like a sore thumb, but something was going on there, whether it was from the earthquake, whether it was from poor construction, poor building materials. I mean, there's so many variables that go into how damage gets rolls out from an earthquake. It's really hard to actually point a finger at one thing and say, that was it.
So that makes it complicated when you're talking about awareness and when you're trying to talk about these kinds of things. People want something a little bit more discreet, more black and white, as you say.
Well, they do. And, you know, we're talking about liquefaction. And so people will think, well, if I live in Salt Lake Valley, I'm going to suffer from liquefaction. Well, that's not necessarily true. There are areas of the valley that are more prone to that than others. And we have that mapped out. All the communities know where those are. They have these building requirements will reflect those zones that have been created. So we are doing some. We can always do better.
Mm. Keith Cooper, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I would just say that it is tough to, assess hazard on a block by block basis. Things change pretty quickly, based on the building structure and the ground. You know, the sediment or how thick the soil is, or things like this. And in general, to be further away from the fault trace, and the caller was right along 1300, that is the fault trace basically. You know, the closer you are to something like that, there is a little bit higher hazard. Now, in terms of the building codes, I'm sure there's a lot of complicated issues that go into that. People want to do economic development. There's a trade-off with that versus public safety. There's a lot of stakeholders involved in negotiations. And I don't know too much about that, but I imagine that comes into into play?
Well, you know, to follow up on that, you know, we're not building, you know, residential homes to withstand this earthquake. Our earthquake that our homes are being built to is more like a 6.5. So homes are being built to life safety standard, which means that the structure should survive the event. Doesn't mean it'll be habitable after, but it'll still be standing, allowing the occupants to get
out.
Why?
Is it possible to build to such a high standard? I mean, that would, you wouldn't.
It's expensive.
You wouldn't.
Well, there's an added expense. It's not that much more, but this is, again,
boundary.
Arena of compromise.
Yeah, the balance.
Right, mm-hmm. Where the balance comes mm-hmm. in. I mean, people need to be aware that just because they're in a newer home, that's not a guarantee.
Let me read an email. It comes from Amy in Salt Lake City. Like many people in central Salt Lake City, my family and I live in an unreinforced masonry home. We're taking all steps we can afford to make our home safer, such as bolting the walls to the foundation, but our walls and chimneys terrify me, she writes. What is the safest place to be in such a home during the big one? Under a sturdy table? We sort of dealt with that, but you guys want to take that on again? You ducking?
Well, people ask this all the time. Where's the best place to be in your house? Well, quite frankly, it doesn't much matter. It's where you're at when the earthquake hits. I mean, that's, you know, you're not going to get to make a choice. Damage is fairly instantaneous yeah. from mm-hmm. ground shaking. So what my advice is to look at every room, where would be the best place in every room that you're in to duck and cover, to give yourself some level of protection, even in unreinforced masonry, because even as bad a construction as it is, there's no guarantee that it's going to totally collapse. I think total collapses, as we talked about earlier, where the media chases, I mean, you would think some of these areas are just totally devastated when, in fact, they've only taken a small chunk. And Mary Lou can talk to this about the Loma Prieta earthquake, where you saw everything in San Francisco, but you really didn't see any information coming from Santa Cruz. And Santa Cruz was a lot closer to the epicenter, had a lot more damage. So you got this skewed view of that particular earthquake.
I would add, though, in an unreinforced masonry home, and, you know, the caller is concerned, and for good reason, the interior walls in these homes are typically wood frame walls. They're going to do a whole lot better than the exterior walls, where the bricks could, you know, some portion of the wall could fall in. So if it were my home and given a preference, I would go toward an interior wall where, you know, their walls might crack and things, but you might be a lot safer from any harm coming from windows breaking or bricks falling inwards.
And there are other things you can do to sort of earthquake proof your house. There's things you might want to bolt in the water heater. You can do things like on your shelves. You don't store the very heavy things at the top of a bookcase or the top of a shelf. You might not want a big heavy picture that's in the wall over your bed because that could fall off. You know, so there are little things like that you can do that can make things at least a little bit safer during an earthquake.
She also raises this question. We've gotten this question from other people. Is there any assistance from the federal government or state government to help pay for this?
No.
Go ahead, Barry. Go ahead. No, go ahead, Bob.
Well, in some instances, depending on the type of structure you have, I know that there's monies out there for if you have a historic home that you want to do this to. There is money out there. As part of what the Seismic Safety Commission in Utah is trying to do through one of its committees is to come up with incentives on the local level where you can get some incentives, some relief in, say, your building permit for people that want to go in and try to make these buildings safer. And our primary objective is kind of the roof to wall connection, because it's relatively easier to do, especially during a re-roof. Mm. So there are some things that we're trying to work on to help in that arena, but there's no real relief right now.
That's Bob Carey, Earthquake Program Manager for Utah's Division of Homeland Security. Mary Lou Zoback with us, Vice President of Risk Application for RMS in Newark, California. Keith Koper with us, Director of the University of Utah Seismograph Stations. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. Thank you. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about earthquakes. Let's go back to the phones. Katie is with us in Holiday, Utah. Katie, welcome.
Hi, I'm Dress. It's the elementary school that I want to ask your guests about today. Our kids go to school on 2700 East and about 53rd South, and I've been told before that this school is not safe in case of an earthquake. I've asked my PTA and just the very local neighbors, we haven't lived here that long, what do we do to have our school made safe? And I've had not only think I'm like, the sky is falling, but they also have no idea what to do. What can we do to make sure our kids are safe at school?
Bob Carey, let's start with you on that question. It's a concern of yours, I know, in schools. And for those who – you cut out a little bit there, Katie, but I guess you got the essence of what she was getting at.
Well, one of the things is that through this particular legislative session, the legislature has indicated that they really think that seismic safety belongs at the local level in the school district. School districts, I think, in general, are well aware of the problem. I think – a lot of it is a funding issue because you can't just fix everything all at once. And that's just the nature of the beast. First of all, knowing that you're in an older school would cause me to want to make sure that the student population, faculty, staff are aware of what to do in an earthquake, do earthquake drills. Every school is supposed to have an emergency plan as part of administrative rule in the state. So maybe talk to the school officials about that. Schools are required to do drills, primarily fire drills, but nonetheless, those can morph into how you would do it during an earthquake. So there's some things that are going on out there. For like the past 5 or 6 years, we've been doing an earthquake drill in April when we do our Earthquake Preparedness Week. We'll be pushing the districts to do that again, and most of them do. So there is some level of preparedness going on at the school level.
Here's an email from Chris, who writes from Pleasant Grove, Utah. He wants to have you comment on the difference between the effect of a quake of given magnitude for a building on the upthrown side of the fault compared to being on the downthrown side. Does that make sense to you, Keith Cooper?
Yeah, that's right. So we have a normal fault here in Utah. And so that means there's a hanging wall and a foot wall, and the hanging wall is going to tend to slide down. And so that would be west of 13th, essentially, is going to slide down. And so that would be the, I know they can't see my hands, but that would be the downside. And in general, it's better to be on the foot wall, which would be sort of to the east of 13th. But this is an active area of research. Hmm. And you know, there's even specialists that disagree about this. But in general, it's better to be, I think, to the east and be on the hanging wall. You know, that side of the fault, you're less likely to have liquefaction. You're probably less likely to have the reverberations in the valley that Mary Lou had alluded to earlier. And so, you know, I wouldn't want to say 100% because, as we talked about earlier, it's not, you know, black and white. But in general, I would say being on the foot wall is better.
So a question from Parker in American Fork, as well as Chris in Pleasant Grove, the question of what kind of damage would there be from landslides or large rock slides coming down from the Wasatch Front, and what effect would that have on the benches?
It could have a serious effect on the benches. It could close down roads. Also, back in the mountains, some of the passes could be closed. So it could cause, you know, besides just damage, it could cause a big economic disruption if certain highways are closed. You know, as I-80 goes through, that's a pretty major thoroughfare, you know.
As a planning element for – we're working with FEMA right now on a catastrophic plan related to this 7.0 earthquake. As an assumption we're using, we're basically not – considering being able to move from the Wasatch Front to the Wasatch Back. So all these passes are going to have rock falls in some form that would preclude us from being able to use. And that's running basically from Spanish Fork Canyon up to Sardine up on the north end. Whether or not it happens that way, maybe, maybe not. But in a planning sense, taking that away, then you look for how you get resources in here in a different fashion. And you also look at areas where you think that you might do debris removal first to allow for that process of bringing materials from out of the state, especially from the east, into the state. So it's a very legitimate problem.
I want to ask a question about, obviously, the question, Mary Lou Zoback, of prediction comes up when you're talking about earthquakes. So someone explained to us that in some ways you're just at the whim of nature. And I'm wondering, is that entirely true? I mean, certainly we're making some ground on being able to say, offer some kind of forecast for people, or are we?
Well, earthquake prediction, the search for some kind of precursory phenomena prior to an earthquake, it's been going on for a long time, and it's actually a field of research that's been revitalized recently. However, I don't have much good news for you. Mm. Lots of people have suggested physical phenomena that might change prior to an earthquake. Really good, you know, we have a pretty good understanding of the physics of what's going on.
Like radon gas, you mean?
There's radon gas. There's changes in the electrical field, the magnetic field, small offsets at depth that we might be able to detect. Then the sad news is that we actually had an earthquake prediction experiment in California, a stretch of the San Andreas Fault in central California, a ranching community, more cows than people. It was a nice place if you're going to have an earthquake to have one. And in fact, over the last 100 plus years, there had been six earthquakes on average every 22 years. The last one before the experiment was set up was in 1966. So everybody said, great, we're going to have an earthquake in 88, 89. Let's put every instrument that everyone's ever suggested, looking at changes in water level and wells, everything was out there. The earthquake occurred a little late. It didn't occur till 2004. And nothing was seen. We knew exactly where the earthquake was going to be. We got that exactly right based on these past earthquakes. We had every kind of instrument out there. It was the most densely instrumented fault in the world. And absolutely nothing was seen ahead of time. Mm-hmm. Now, that said, we are starting, you know, with better broadband technology. We're starting, and we're able to put out lots more sensors. We're starting to see some very small signals. They're essentially tiny earthquakes that are occurring down beneath the level where the actual earthquake that breaks, that creates all the damage. Mm. In this deeper part of the Earth's crust, we started seeing these strange signals. Initially, when they saw them in the Pacific Northwest, they thought maybe it was some Navy experiment going on that they hadn't been told about, because they didn't look like regular earthquakes. They're called tremor. It's sort of continuous vibration of the Earth. Well, careful analysis of tremor and higher, more sophisticated techniques to look at it have shown that prior to that 2004 earthquake in Southern California, at a depth deep in the Earth's crust, these tremor turns out to be thousands and thousands of tiny little earthquakes all occurring right, you know, on top of each other. And there were significant changes in the locations of where the tremor was occurring and migrations that occurred in the months prior to that earthquake. We weren't able to detect this until just a few years ago. So I haven't given up hope for earthquake prediction, but right now, you'll hear people claim something changed. It happens in one earthquake. It's never repeatable. Right now, we don't have the means to do that. But more significantly, if I could tell you all that I had some secret technique, and there's going to be an earthquake in a magnitude 7 earthquake in Salt Lake City tomorrow night at 7, what would you do? Well, I think most people would get out of town, just like we try to evacuate for hurricanes. But the buildings are still going to fall down, right? Nothing. We would definitely save lives. But, you know, the fundamental problem is that earthquakes don't kill people. Buildings do. And getting back to this whole issue of retrofitting buildings, I think it's absolutely criminal that we have schools in earthquake zones. We have them in California. You have them in Utah. They have them in the central U.S. We have schools that are going to kill children. Are we as a society willing to accept that? And, you know, even if the buildings don't collapse, you go into a classroom, typically heavy things are up high. Mm. Keith was talking about this before. I know in our classrooms, electrical wires snake through conduit from roof to roof on different classroom buildings, there's a lot that can be done, and a lot of it is not really expensive. And I would urge the mom that called about her kid's school, get the PTA active on this. I bet in their school community, they've got construction people trained in construction practice. They could probably get permits and do a lot of the simple, straightforward things and make that school safer. So you know, we've got to own this problem.
You know, one thing I read that you had written, Mary Lou Zobeck, is that we need to engage all kinds of people in this conversation, among them social scientists.
Absolutely.
What do you mean by that?
Well, just as I think both Keith and Bob have said, most people that live in the Salt Lake, that live along the Wasatch Front, are now aware that that beautiful landscape that they have, those high mountains that provides them with water all year round, that's the result of repeated earthquakes. Yeah. 6 huge earthquakes on average on different segments in the last 10,000 years. So that seems slow on human time scale, but they're happening. But the problem, and the same thing, exact same thing's true in the Bay Area. If I walked outside and asked somebody, I'd say, what do you think the chances are of a major earthquake in your lifetime? And most people would say, well, it's 67%, because they've heard our numbers. They're not sure what that means, but yeah, they know the number. The problem and the reason we need social scientists involved in risk communication, it's not just knowing there's a risk, but getting people to take action to protect themselves, to protect their families, to protect their communities. And that's the step we need. And even in the Bay Area, people are not prepared anywhere near the degree they should be.
Bob, why? We talked a little bit about denial before. I mean, the sense that, well, you shouldn't build in an earthquake zone. Is there some sense that, well, this whole place is an earthquake zone? It's going to happen at some point. Is there some sort of existential question going on with people that they just, and it goes to the question of denial? I mean, what is it?
Well, I think some people, I mean, there are some people feel that just because it's Utah and it's the home base of the LDS Church, that this wouldn't happen on a religious side.
Wow.
I think some people don't necessarily think that an earthquake that happens on the Salt Lake segment every 1,300 years is anything to worry about.
Been 1,400 years since the last one.
I know. That's the fun part about this on my job, is that I say we're in this window of opportunity, and they all stare at me. It's like, well, this earthquake's probably a lot closer to us now than it is further away. And the thing is when I first started doing this, I talked to how devastating this could be, and people just, I mean, they just turn off. Well, we can't do anything. So we modified right. that to do for this intermediate, this Christchurch type of an event, where you're going to survive this, and there are going to be things that you can do right now to put yourselves in a better position to come out the backside of this, because government's not ever going to be the answer. We saw that in Katrina. You know, Katrina was 90,000 square miles of damage. I mean, that's every direction you look is damage. There's no way anybody can handle something like that. And so that's kind of the message that I go after. You know, government's only so big. There's only so many firemen on duty on any given day. This is why we talk the community emergency response teams, the CERT teams, having those together, because that's where in life people can then start to deal with this, because most rescues in an earthquake come from non-trained personnel. And, that's only done if you've organized yourselves.
And I guess also the message, Keith Cooper, for all of you anyway, are you ready? I mean, what is your plan? Do most people even have a plan?
Yeah, I think most people don't. There are several simple things you can do. And I think Mary Lou said that they're not necessarily expensive. Just making a plan, you know, if the phones aren't working, does everybody in your family, you know somewhere to go after an earthquake? Different routes might not be available. There's sort of simple things you can do, and you want to have maybe a water filter or a store, 3 or 4 day store of drinking water, food, things like this. There's lots of little things you can do to sort of plan ahead and be prepared. And I guess it's just human nature, you know, that it sounds far off. It sounds like it's 1,300 years down the road, and people feel like they have other things to worry about, I guess.
Well, one thing they could do is there's a website they can go to called Be Ready Utah. And if you go to that
we'll put a link on our website.
Maybe. Yeah. If you go to that website, that's specifically made for the community, for individuals, for schools, for things that they can do. And it's got a lot of good information, and it's out of our office. So that would be a good starting point for people that haven't done anything.
Less than a minute here. I wanted you to say something, Bob, about the shakeout coming in April of 2012.
Yeah, we're currently working with FEMA on a earthquake exercise. It'll happen in April of 2012, and there'll be a media push from our office on that. This is where we're going to have the communities along the Wasatch Front related to our Hazus Run participate in a two-day exercise where we put ourselves through the paces so we can see how we interact and work with each other.
Well, again, we'll put all this information on our website. Mary Lou Zoback, Vice President of Risk Applications for RMS in Newark, California, thank you very much for your time today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
And Keith Coper, Director of the University of Utah Seismograph Stations, thanks
very
pleasure.
Much. My pleasure.
Bob Carey, Earthquake Program Manager for the Utah Division of Homeland Security, thanks. Thanks to
you. Thanks for having me on.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Cynthia Martinez. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.
The Great Utah Shakeout takes place tomorrow morning, Tuesday, April 17th at 10:15. If you'd like to learn more about being prepared for an earthquake or about taking part in the statewide drill, visit us at KUER.org/Radio West.